Thanks for coming along tonight, where we are launching Amy Lee's book, Pink Flower, Growing Up in Mao's China, which has just been released, and it's great to be able to launch it here at the Sydney Institute tonight. Now, I'm just going to introduce our speaker in a slightly unusual way, and then to give some details about her, but also a brief details about China since 1949. Now, our speaker, Amy Lee, the author of Pink Flower, was born in Beijing in 1950, in 1968, for reasons she'll explain, was sent to White Pond Village, southwest of Beijing. In 1975, she left the village of White Pond to study English in what I pronounce that Shanxi University in Taiyuan. Yeah. In 1978, she graduated and went to work in Taiyuan Machinery College. In 1988, she returned to Beijing to teach at the College of Automotive Engineering. In 1992, Amy Lee came to Sydney and privately taught English to business men and women and others while she studied mathematics at the University of Sydney. And then she taught mathematics in high schools in Sydney and at a coaching college until she retired in 2016. Now, just before we start our talk, I just want to just briefly run through. Many people on this in the room here and on the call will know this, but I just want to go through it. October 1949, the Communist Party of China comes to power. In 1950, there's the suppression of the counter-revolutionaries, that is those who are said to oppose the revolution. 1951 to October 1952, Mao Zedong launches the Three Antis campaign targeted at Communist Party officials. In early 1952, there was also the Five Antis campaign targeted at business. May 1956, Mao's 100 Flowers campaign commences under the heading Let 100 Flowers Bloom and 100 Schools of Thought Contend to encourage debate and discussion within China. But he doesn't really appreciate everything that he hears, and this commences the anti-rightist campaign, R-I-G-H-T-I-S-T, rightist campaign. And as Ted Ruhl points out in his foreword to this book, those who were purged at that time were not finally released, some of them until 1978. In 1958 to 1962, the Great Leap Forward, in which an estimated figure of somewhere between 30 million and 45 million died. 1966 to 76, the Cultural Revolution, and June 1989, Tiananmen Square. Now, our speaker was involved, was around for all of that except the Communist Party coming to power in October 1949. Now, as I mentioned, Ted Ruhl, who's a specialist on China, who's here tonight and written a lot of important material on China over the years, has done the foreword to this book, and he praises it. And one of the reasons why he praises it, we had Yung Chan here talking about Wild Swans some years ago. But she is from what is called the Red Classes. And tonight we've got Amy Lee, who is from what are called the Black Classes. Ted Ruhl makes the point there's been a lot of books put out, or a number of books, memoirs put out of people from the Red Classes. But he reckons this is the first book from someone in the Black Classes. So, you're born in 1950, so you were born to black class parents. Who are black class parents compared with white class parents?
Compared with the red.
I'm sorry, compared with red class parents.
Yeah. So the red class is the workers, peasants, especially poor peasants, and basically it's just poor class. And the black class is the before the 1949, the Chinese Communist Party took over, you were a businessman, or you work in the government, the national government, or if you are a high authority of under the other regime, under the Kuomintang, like whatever, even education department, or in the army, or as long as you are high in rank before the 1949 and not in the communist So you're black. And another black is, there's five black peasants, the rich peasants, anti-revolutionary, that means some baddies. So whatever in the prison for the whatever the system, like people do the normal bad things, then and the the rightist, the rightist is added on the after the anti-rightist. So there's five of them count as the anti-revolutionary, the black. Then the rest is between, is neither red nor black, depends on your basically economical situation. The poorer, the closer to the red. The richer, closer to the black.
So just, you were a black from the black class. Tell us why, because your father was not, as I recall, a supporter of the Kuomintang. He wasn't really involved in that period, but he was in business. So what was he doing in business?
He just have a little factory and a few shops selling this kind of top hats, Western style top hats. And so because he has a business and he has a factory, has workers, has a few shops, so it's black.
So you describe your parents as Buddhist.
Yeah.
Were they very serious Buddhist, or were they sort of every now and then Buddhist? I mean,
father was a very devoted Buddhist. My mother was also a Buddhist, but he just a family woman, so he don't go outside because he has a bound foot. So he don't go out, he just worship at home. And my father's mother living at home, so he would have a statues. He very devoted and pray all the time. And my mother was just part of that culture. But my father was a vegetarian because a Buddhist don't eat meat if he's very devoted. Even in the very hard times, my mother would eat whatever the government supplied. You have meat, eat meat. Whatever supply for the kids, for the family.
So
even then, my father don't eat meat.
So you describe, you've got a couple of very interesting pages here about, I think it's your maternal grandmother who has the bound foot, right? A bound feet.
My mother. My mother have bound feet.
Okay.
All his ancestors, everyone before him, older than her, would have bound feet.
Now, so
she was the last generation.
The last generation.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, as I said, you're born in 1950.
Yeah.
And the Great Leap Forward, or it used to be called the Great Leap Forward when I was at university, but they now just call it the Leap Forward.
Okay.
I didn't call it the Great Leap Forward, but others did. So that, just explain first to us what was the Leap Forward, and secondly, how it affected you. So tell us, what was the Leap Forward starting in 1958, ending around 4 years later?
Okay, that Great Leap is basically the iron and the steel production. The Chairman Mao wanted he believed that China was backward because the iron and the steel production was too low. So he decided to catch up with the Britain and catch up with the America in 15 years. So that's a great leap forward to try to jump to catch up. And his way to catch up is get everybody make at the backyard, every school, and every factory, every working unit, every village would make a backyard furnace, put all the metal things in it to melt it, to make iron and steel. Because back then, at that time, is after the anti-rightist campaign. So all the technical specialists were condemned. So we were sent away or in prison. That's about 50 million of them across the country. So no expert actually know, especially Mao, how this iron and steel produced. So he made such a big scale effort, but of course produced nothing. So the way to affect me was, as a child, we at school, we encouraged to pick up all the metals on the street or at home, and even every family, the cooking ware have to contribute it, leave the minimum to cook. Everything, spoons, everything. Just, then we use the China spoon, just everything hand in to make steel. And so the whole country, especially in the countryside, because the peasants started to have to do this, because the furnace, once start, you can't stop it. So it's 24 hours. So they cut down whatever the tree they can find, the forest all now cut off, and they just feed this for years, continuously. So that's why, and in the harvest time, there's nobody, no actually the strong now workers work in the fields. So much crops were just rotten. That's why the famine. So I was affected by the famine. So everybody was starving. Even in the Beijing was the best city, the most protected city. So we just have rations. You have a certain amount of rations the government supply. And that's the only thing. And you don't have anything else. You don't have eggs or meat or any snacks. So just that flour, your government supplied, you make some bread and cornbread. So everybody is hungry. So every time, all the time. So my memory of that period is just hungry. You're hungry all the time. So I've written that my mom have to go to the land park, the parkland to pick up the wild things, wild grass things, to feed us. And we have some other little subsidies because I talked about my aunt. My aunt lived with us, her husband in Hong Kong. In 1956, my father's business and all the business was confiscated, just become nationalized. And my uncle was in Hong Kong. He attended business in Hong Kong, Singapore, and some other places. So he wasn't in China. So he decided not to come back. So my aunt and her children just live with us. We live in a compound in a courtyard. And because of the foreign currency is mostly needed. So every month he received, my uncle would send the money to the family and the government would give you equivalent amount of coupon. So they would change the money. You can't change by yourself. Somebody would come to give you Chinese money and a coupon to prove that you have this amount of foreign currency. With this coupon, you can go to that special shop. There's only one special shop in whole Beijing where you can get everything.
So now you're at school. You're at school, but like most people in Beijing, you're hungry most of the time. But unlike people in the rural areas, there's not a great death rate there. So you're at school. So tell us about what did you learn at school and what did you learn from Li Fang? I mean, you know what I mean.
All right, yeah.
Li Fang was the, tell us about Li Fang.
Okay. Lei Feng, his, yeah, in Chinese pronunciation, the Lei Feng. Lei Feng was a young soldier, and she was born in 1940, I think, and she lost his parents at year seven years old, and she was grown up now under the care of the relatives. So she's a really good boy. She was so grateful. So when she becomes a became a worker, she helped everybody, and she worked very hard, and you know, all the workers liked him, and she became a model worker. Then she joined, he joined the army. In the army, he's a model soldier. His best behavior is he helped others all the time, in every way, and he studied Chairman Mao's books. At that time, he just write everything, right? So how grateful, how good this society is, and he has food to eat, and he has clothes to wear, just so happy for what he has. So it's happened that he, now Mao's second hand, that's General Marshal Lin Biao, was the head of the army, want to promote Mao cult, so make him the model soldier, and write this whole story about him on the newspaper. So newspaper now put this whole story there. Then Mao write, learn from Lei Feng. So everybody, all people learn from Lei Feng. So this becomes a slogan of our school. So every child learn to be a little Lei Feng. So what you need to do is help others. The typical thing is you help somebody cross the road and share your umbrellas with others. It's very good, because at school, then everybody try to do something good, and it make the whole school very clean, and the classroom clean, and everything is clean, so everybody is friendly. So we feel so happy. So now it's like a big family, living in a big family. But we didn't realize that back then we start to see everything. Now, thank Chairman Mao, thank the party, and you're loyal to the party, loyal to Chairman Mao, not to your family. Especially if you're from a black family, you can't loyal to your family, you have to betray your family. That's the right behavior. You have to report if your parents say something wrong. You have to have we call it class consciousness. So know that your parents are black. So if they say something not according to Chairman Mao's works, according to Lei Feng, not so grateful, you should report to the teacher.
Now, Lei Feng had a diary, and you had a diary, but you burnt your diary. Why? Yes.
Okay, that's because Lei Feng died at the year of 22 years old in an accident in the army. So his diary was published. Yes, right, so grateful to the party, so everything, Chairman Mao's words, Chairman Mao says, Chairman Mao. So the teacher would encourage us, everybody write, how do you write, how do you learn from Lei Feng, how do you help others, how do you not understand Chairman Mao's teachings. So everybody write diaries. So it become a way of self-exam, like everyone, you just shouldn't have any ungrateful thinking, the bad thinking. Anything, if you feel that's not standard, not as good as Lei Feng, you should learn from him to be as little Lei Feng. So kind of self-exam all the time about your behavior. Then, a year later, I think, everybody have to read your diary. See, the, what did you do, what good things you did, what do you think, how did you understand now Chairman Mao's teaching, things like this. Then one girl in the class said, from a black family she was, she said she found a note, some little money on the ground, $2, 2 Chinese yen, and she picked up, she thought, oh, this is good, I can buy some sweets. Then she thought, no, I should hand to the teacher. So she handed to the teacher. Then the teacher said, somebody said, this is good, but you first have dirty thoughts. Why didn't you straight away hand to the teacher? You first think to have it yourself. This is because you're from a black family. You have black thoughts in your mind, so you should, you finally did the right thing, but you have black thoughts in your brain. And another boy has a similar, almost the same thing, pick up some money and give it to the teacher, said, oh, this is good, this is just the behavior we should do, and it's a proud of your family because you're from a poor family, but you don't keep the money. So I started to worry, because then I go back to read my diary. I thought, a lot of things I written, I don't know it's black or not. For example, I would have some questions, I would talk to my father, talk to my mother, and I miss my grandmother. So I think about her. I thought, wow, this, my grandmother is, of course, is also black. So I thought, if this is a black thought, I may now do something harm to my parents. So what can I do? So I thought, I burn it. I burn the diary. I said, I would tell the teacher I don't have a diary.
So you're pretty switched on, because you burn your diary in 1965 and the Cultural Revolution starts in 1966. Now, there's a lot of material in your book about it, but just tell us a bit about how it affected you at the school. So when it starts, mm-hmm. you had a very close friend who was a friend of your family called Sally, right?
Yeah.
So who was she and what happened to her? And secondly, around this time, your father's taken away.
Yeah.
So what happened to him? And your house was raided. What happened to it? So let's start, get through just about 3 or 4 minutes. What happens with the Cultural Revolution to you?
Okay, with the Cultural Revolution started, the family background become the most important thing. So black students singled out. We have 4 blacks in our class with 50 students. So we become the enemy. So nobody would talk to us. And my best friend, Sally was from a working class at year 9. I think that because she has to do a lot of work, help her mother. So her father worked hard but couldn't feed the family. So mother has to do things. So she helped her mother do a lot of needlework and put the buttons on just some work, take home and earn a little money. So she missed some lessons. So she academically behind. So the teacher said, everybody below this level, you choose a person to sit with. So Sally chose me. So she become my, we sit at the same table, one table, sit two students. And every day after class, we'll go together to my home and do homework. So play together. My mom also gave her some little lollies or whatever. And then we become good friends. This went on for about a little bit more than, about a year. And the Cultural Revolution started. The moment the Cultural Revolution started, she was the red, I was the black. And so she never talked to me anymore. Then I think the 5th of August, that's the day that Chairman Mao published an article, important article. Anyway, and then the broadcast, the loudspeaker called me to the board, to the notice board, and 8 red in my class lying there. And for some reason I know I have to leave them. They are going to raid my family because all the black families have to be raided. The house has to be raided. So I didn't expect I was the first in my class, my family house to be raided. Because Sally wanted to show he was red. He was firmly on the red side. So that's why he decided to pick up my family. He was one of the leaders. In our class, each class has two leaders. One leader, the second is executive leader. In our class, the leader was the head, the real head was a girl from a revolutionary family. But that girl is very mild, didn't not want to do anything like that at all. But because her parents were party members, so she has to be the head. And Sally is a bit bold because I wrote something about her younger life, fighting with her father to protect her mother. Anyway, she become the real leader. She's the second hand, but she become the real person to decide everything. So she decided I was the first one. So I just have to take them. She actually know my home, where it is. We went every day, but I have to lead them. No, they follow me to raid my house. And the house is completely emptied.
So that's very sad. We'll come back to her at the end. We'll move quickly through. Now, at this stage, your father sent away. So your father's obviously, as you mentioned earlier, he's a black. So he sent away. Where does he send to, and how long has he stayed here for?
Okay, he was just disappeared in his factory. He worked in his factory. And when the Cultural Revolution started, there's a lot of fighting sessions. And the blacks or the authorities, the directors or whoever party secretaries, whoever is the head, then it would become the enemy and become the subject of the great mass, the rebellers. The rebellers, now my father, of course, is black and now the part of the management of the factory. So he was condemned, and one way of the condemnation is just you are not going to go home, and you not get paid. So his salary stopped, and he just have to be there all the time on call for any meeting, for any condemnation meeting. So he's not allowed to go home anymore. He's in his factory. So when we first, for more than a week, didn't see him, and my mother said he didn't take the money. This month didn't get the pay. And my brother went to visit him. That's the only time and the last time he saw him. And my father was just after a condemnation, the second or third day after condemnation party. And one of the particular radical is a person that now kicked my father. My father just said, if next meeting, if next rally, if he did that again, I would fight back. Then he is a person that, anyway, that my brother said, no, said, this thing is not for directly because of you. It's everybody, everywhere. They just try to show they are revolutionary. So if they kick you or whatever, you just try to protect you, but don't fight back. So my father didn't fight back. And his assistant, that my, we call him Uncle Shen. Uncle Shen is my father's assistant, and he worked for my father from very early age when my father first started this business. And they like brothers work together. So the condemnation party now rally also condemned him and asked him to condemn my father. And then he refused. So this person, you know, radicals kicked him, bashed him, and he said something, upset that person, and said, "You will be punished." And that person said, "You will be punished now." So beat him badly, just blood everywhere. Then locked him up in a tool room. So no food, no drink, no medicine or that. That night, he committed suicide. So that make us think that if my father did anything, maybe he would be dead too.
You don't hear about your father for 10 years?
Yeah, then okay. We never heard about him anymore.
Okay, we're just going to move quickly through this now, but also very briefly, your teacher, Mrs. Liang, is it? She was murdered, right?
Yeah, that's right.
By the Red Guards.
That's right. Yeah. That's.
Now, you're sent away to the country in 1968, and you're there for, 7 years, is that right? At the age of 18?
Yeah.
So you go into this in great detail in the book, but you're sent from, now we have a map here, which you'll see, you're sent from Beijing to what is called the White Pond Village.
Oh, the White Pond Village, this is number three.
Number three, yeah. So it's about, what, 2,000 kilometres?
No, this is about less than 1,000.
1,000 kilometres north, southwest of Beijing. Okay, so you're there for all up, you're there for, 7 or 8 years now.
7 years.
We're going to move reasonably soon to questions. So just give us a brief idea. Well, rather than, I mean, obviously being sent away to a distant place was a pretty grim outcome, and you say that you're worried it was a death sentence, but just tell us, it was relieved a bit by, if we go back to the, victims of the anti-rightist campaign that followed the 100 Flowers Bloom period.
Yeah.
So you refer to them as Mr. J and Mr. Sun. Yeah. So these men have been purged in 1958, and you come in, you meet them 10 years later, and they're still in this village where you end up. But obviously, that's a great it's a great benefit to you because you meet educated men, and you're trying to get educated yourself.
Yes. That's in the village. When I was sent to the village, I now saw two men. Obviously, they're not peasants. They were just not white-haired. From the manner, you know, they're scholars. And then after the winter, we arrived there that December. Then next spring, we have a peach tree in our courtyard. And one day this door was pushed open, and these two gentlemen walked into our courtyard and to appreciate this peach, the peach flowers. So that's the first time I really get to have some words with him, talked to them. Then I found out Mr. Sun told me that they have books, because I was reading my English textbooks from school, because I only took two books from the country. One is English textbook and the other is mathematics textbook. So I have nothing to read except Chairman Mao's books. So it happened that day I was reading the English, and he said, "Oh, you're reading English." I said, "That's the only book I have. The other is mathematics." So when they leave, they told me that I have some books. You can come if you like. And they came to our courtyard to appreciate this peach tree because they actually planted them. And they planted 4 or 6, but just this one survived. And our house was originally was the little office of our brigade. So they emptied that now for us to leave. So that's why they come in. They didn't realize it's occupied by the city students. And then I also realized that they don't want to talk to us before, keep at a distance, because they thought that these are all red guards. They know how bad this Cultural Revolution in Beijing. Their friends were bashed up, and now someone wasn't rightist, didn't dismissed to the country, wasn't exiled, but in the Cultural Revolution suffered much more. Some died. So they thought these young students are all red guards. But of course, we exchanged a lot of messages, and I gradually asked that to visit them. They just live 2 minutes from me. So it's not a too big village, you just everybody. We are in the same brigade. So it's the best thing happened in my life. So every day I spend some hours with them to read a lot of literatures and history, and they taught me so much classical Chinese. And Mr. Sun is a senior editor of the Chinese publication, what's that called? People's Education Publish Press. Just all over the China's textbooks of schools is from that press. So he is one of the senior editor, and his original lineage was a painter. He was a Chinese painter, and he's so good at classical Chinese, and he learned French and English, because when he was learning painting, the teacher at the school was now foreign teachers. They speak French, a lot of speak French. So they use French and English. So he was good at English and French, and they have little radio. It's a good thing in the country, they find it better than Beijing, they think, because they can listen to the enemy station. But in those isolated area, nobody actually interfere with them. And they use battery, there's no electricity. Because he understand English and French, so I also started to learn these two languages, but I didn't go too far with the French. And but English, I learned something.
So we're going to move on very quickly now to finish this part of it. Yeah. So as those who've got the map will see that you've got one of your siblings is up here, right up
my north sister there, is there.
Your sister, your brothers, that's number two, your brother's down at number four, not that far from you. You're at number three.
Yeah.
Beijing is at number one. But eventually you get out of the area where you're forced to be, and in time you get back to Beijing. You've obviously got a deep devotion to your mother, who you see, and you catch up with your father, who's released. So people can read about that. But now let's move on, because finally, and I want to be very brief on this, finally... So when you're born in 1950, you're caught up in all of this, but you're also caught up in Tiananmen Square because you're teaching at a university near Tiananmen Square when the demonstrations occur around the middle of 1989.
Yes.
So just very briefly, just we'll conclude on this and we'll go to questions. Very briefly, you were cycling around Tiananmen Square looking at stuff. You weren't part of the demonstration, but you saw people who were in the demonstration, including some who were killed.
Yes. When I went back to work in Beijing, and my family live in the college area. So the most famous eight universities, oldest and famous universities is in our area. So across the road is Renmin University, the People's University. And about 2 kilometers is Beijing University and Tsinghua University. So in that area. And then this college I work is before is part of the Tsinghua University. They have this campus in the city, right in behind the Forbidden City. So from the college to the Tiananmen Square, just now, a few minutes now by bicycle. And when they start, the students hunger strike start, all the people in Beijing support them. So we go to the, there's a commercial street. All people from the business, they donate food and drink to the students. So we organized to collect these donations and send to the square. So every day, every lunchtime, I would go to a particular snack shop, get 20 boxes of lunch boxes and take to the school about a 5 or 8 minutes walk. And then the students would carry all these boxes, collected food and drink, sent to Tiananmen Square. So we have now, also because of the news, can't, a lot of things you can't get from the news, so we are so close. So every teacher would go to the square to report what's happening, this and that. So we closely now related to that. And that's everybody is talking about at that time, and everybody is doing. So all the teachers contributed to something like, to give them drink, this kind of transportation of the food to support them. So everyone just joined with this, because this, that time is so high-spirited and so hopeful. We think this, we're going to really fight the now for democracy, and the government is so good. We are so trusted the Deng Xiaoping, and the government did so much good things, and the economy is revived, and the people's life is much, much better. Is still, everything is rationed, but you can buy things from the market. And so anyway, people full of hope. And so we have so many connections with the square and with the students, our students. And also because I live in this college street with the university, so I have two classes in two universities. One university is across the road. I taught a Sunday class because in China back then is have a fever of English. So everybody try to learn English, especially university students. So they have this after hours class. And especially this special class called the TOEFL class. TOEFL is a special American test. So, okay. So I have a Sunday class in the Renmin University and a Saturday class in Beihang University. So my students in the Beihang University, four of them actually joined the hunger strike. So I talked something about that part in the book. Now, they actually, two of them on the night of the killing in the square, two of them left the square, but two was there. And I saw that when they come back from square, it's just so upset, and they're crying to talking what happened. One of the students was killed on that date, and they come back. One of the worker actually helped collected 5 dead bodies and put them on the flat just a tricycle.
Yeah.
And transported to the university next to us. And one of the body has a card, student card, said our university. That's the university I taught the Saturday class. So the broadcast said, who knows Guan Min, is Guan Min from this school, from what? Then people start to realize that, oh yes, wanted to send people to identify this is Guan Min's body.
Okay, Vic. You've got a very interesting chapter in the book about how you assess what happened in Tiananmen Square and how the government reacted and how the demonstrators reacted, and people can follow that.
Yeah.
Now, we've got about 15 minutes left, so we'll come to questions and discussion. We keep your questions brief and the responses brief. So, Anne.
Well, there's one question here from the Zoom audience. It's from Ida Lichter, who asks, what are the legacies of Mao's China still evident in China today?
China today? Mao is still the supreme people to be respected. And my friends in China would send me messages now and then, say in the party's birthday, the 1st of July, they would send that, say, celebrate the Communist Party's 100 years birthday, I think. So, and all the celebrations in every day, important day, like a National Day, Party's birthday, Army's birthday, that's the 1st of October, this 1st of, August, 1st of August. Anyway, they send this type of things. And before they would send all different messages, then they send a notice that the group has to be disciplined to not say anything that the newspaper didn't say, and don't pass rumors without any proof, don't pass rumors. And they started to send these celebrations, celebrate. So it's a pretty normal for the ordinary people.
I've got a question. You've got to be brief, okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Being a teacher, China is divided, the hukou system, between the rural and the cities.
Yeah.
Rural people have nothing like the education opportunities of those in the cities. They're the vast majority, they're poor, jobs have gone as the assembly line workers finished. What's going to happen with this huge divide in China?
Well, that's a contemporary question. Whether you want to talk about contemporary China.
Yeah, I think that the hukou system was very strict, but now is a bit relaxed because a lot of rural peasants come to the city to work. And of course, their children, because they don't have a hukou, the children can't attend school. But the people can buy food from not rationed. So it's compared to back then, it's much more relaxed. And there's too much details.
Okay,
shall
we go?
I want to go back to your story.
Yeah.
For someone living in a place like Australia, for you to have been almost turned into a leper, sent away to the country,
mm-hmm.
your schooling ended, and yet you've come through all of this, and you've obviously learnt languages, history. I know you've met those scholars, and they gave you the chance.
Yeah.
But how did you survive? What was it in you that got you through, and your family?
I think we just deal with everything, whatever comes in your life, you just have to deal with it. And my mother told me that, and her own experience also taught her that you just do whatever you can, do your best, prepare for the worst. And he gave me the best advice, support me all the time, is keep a cool head and a hot heart, the warm heart, cool head. So everything you do, you just don't do by impulse, you think. So from the book, you will see at every stage, and have a little chance, I work in the village school and teach in the, I taught in the village school, then I now make my best and will help with the help of my tutor, with my teachers, Mr. Sun and Mr. Jia. And I taught well, and also I was offered another job in the county school. So just gradually, whenever I have an opportunity, I think I just actually took the opportunity. It's a kind of intuitive. When the seeing something come up like a barefoot doctor, I have a chance to help the villager to do some acupuncture. So I just start to help. Now, so the doctor helped me, he liked my help. So just every stage I have some opportunity, I just do it. And if I have no chance, I simply don't try. We decided, my friends and me, we decided not to get married, just remain single, because we don't want our children to be in the village. So we decided not have a boyfriend or girlfriend. So even if you actually want.
Second answer, don't be very great.
What a great talk. I mean, we're all in great admiration of you, what you've done. You'd be familiar with the Romance of the Three Kingdoms, of course.
Yes.
And there is a famous inscription at the start of it. Divided, the empire must unite. United must divide. Where do you think China is now on that timescale?
Chinese people all believe this unite is better than divide. Because in history, all the periods of divided country were full of laws, to warlords fighting to each other, and different countries fighting to each other. And if you examine the whole history, the divided history might be the same or even longer than the actually united. And we united, it's more peaceful. Not so many wars, and until the end of a certain dynasty, and the empress is not become relaxed and become corrupted, then there's a peasants' rebellion, and get rid of this emperor, and another dynasty. Between the dynasties would have famines, lots, the wars, and so people believe united is the best. So that's why the Communist Party also know what the people want. So they say we make all the efforts to be united, to be one. You have to be under the Communist Party. So people, like or not, ordinary people don't care too much about it, actually. But intellectuals, with the feel a lot of pressure, freedom, yeah.
Okay, sorry, just finish that up. You feel a lot of pressure?
My friends of intellectual working in the universities and stuff, so they feel no freedom, but they can't do anything. Most of them retired, so just say, okay, just do as whatever I can, yeah.
So one of our people on the call asked about you and China. You mentioned right at the end of your book, you visit in 2010, you meet your classmates. So very briefly, what was that experience like? And was it Sally, the woman who, or the young girl who persecuted you at school?
Yeah.
Tell us, or tell the people here, what happened to her.
Okay. 2010, I went to visit Beijing. One of my friends invited me. They organized a reunion of my classmates. 26 were there, and I couldn't recognize any of them, except the one that visited me during the in the country, because we haven't seen each other for 40 years. So when we now left Beijing is 18, so when we meet is 60, 42 years. So I can't recognize any of them. Anyway, now this, they told me we have four friends died. One is Sally. Sally committed suicide. It's because in the Cultural Revolution, she was, everybody was sent to the country, and three of the reds stayed in Beijing working factory. So she was one of those three in our class in Beijing, and she become, of course, she joined the Communist Party, and she become the factory party secretary. So quite good. So everything for her is so beautifully developed. Then one of the young people in the now is a secretary of the Youth League, work under her, but she fell in love with that boy. But that boy didn't fall in love with her, so married another woman. So Sally actually attended their wedding, but after the wedding, she still chased this boy. Nobody realized actually she was have some mental problems, but then she was discovered and sent into hospital and for some treatment back twice. And then the last time when she come out of the hospital, that's 1975. So just she was ill in the hospital, Chairman Mao died. So when she came out of the hospital, everything changed. And in the factory, people don't respect her anymore. And she thought everybody is judging her. So by then, she was clear-headed. She was completely recovered. But she thought there's no future for her, because anyone in the radicals, she was one of them, like the leader under the Gang of Four. So she committed suicide.
We could go on for longer, but we always finish on time. I just want to remind everyone, we've got copies of Amy Lee's book, Pink Flower, Growing Up in Mao's China. I mentioned Ted Rule is here tonight. He's written the foreword, who describes it as an extraordinary story by an extraordinary woman, and I commend it to her. And it is an extraordinary story. And we were saying before the talk commenced that you're a very unusual person these days, because you read the book and you've had enormous emotional and physical suffering, and you don't complain. How do you fit into our society? That's what I want to know. But before we wrap up, I'd just say many thanks to Rafe Champion, who you describe as effectively the co-author of this book. Ruth's been a member here for many years, and we're very grateful for you drawing this to our attention. It's been a great honour to launch your book at the Sydney Institute tonight. There are copies for sale tonight. There'll be some copies for sale online. But for tonight, well done, and you're a courageous woman.
Thank you.